You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Tom.
Hey, Bob. How are you?
I can't complain. How are you doing?
I'm good. It's I can't complain either. And if I did, no one would care. But it's I can't complain.
Oh, yeah. Tom. Millions of enthusiastic readers care about you.
That's right.
Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. And this is a Non-Zero Podcast. You are Thomas Friedman, well-known and Pulitzer Prize-winning author and columnist for the New York Times. You write about foreign affairs. We're going to talk about, I think, both Ukraine and Taiwan. You actually wrote a very interesting column today connecting the two. You know, as of airtime, I believe, or as of recording time, Nancy Pelosi was still apparently going to go to Taiwan. She may.
She's there now.
She's arrived.
Having her meetings, yeah. Sounds like she's just going to stay for the day and not even overnight. But
well, I guess that might, maybe that's an improvement. But in any event, your column I found really interesting because it made a kind of argument against her going that was a little different from the arguments I had heard. I mean, everyone had talked about tensions with Taiwan, potentially explosive, World War III, and so on. You had a slightly different point to make connecting this to Ukraine. Do you want to run over that for us?
Yeah, two points I was trying to make, Bob. One a general one, one a specific one. The general one is it's deeply unwise for the United States to be putting itself where it's in a potential conflict, indirect conflict, with the two other global superpowers at the same time, China and Russia. I mean, that's sort of basic to me, geopolitics 1001. But the broader point I was making is that I believe we should keep our eye on the prize. I think the prize is stalling and if possible, reversing of Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine. And that should be priority number one. And because that's my priority number one, and I think should be America's priority number one, we need to keep in mind that early in the war, President Biden, his National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, sat down with their Chinese counterparts and had some really tough discussions. The nub of which was that China should not, must not provide military aid to Russia in this war. There was a lot of back and forth with Biden basically telling the Chinese, understand your two biggest export markets are the EU and the United States, and those would be imperiled if you did. And the Chinese, for their own national interests, their own calculations, both economic and military, decided not to help Russia. And that has been very important for the American war effort. Let's remember, China's DJI company is considered the greatest drone maker in the world. They make civilian drones, but you can bet they can make military ones. There's nothing Putin needs more right now than drones. He's evidently run through most of his. And one of the reasons he was believed to have gone to Tehran, Bob, 2 weeks ago, was actually to enlist the Iranian drone industry on his side. So in any ways, I thought the fact that China, we had made this big request, China had acceded to this request, and I've confirmed it from everywhere. They're not providing military arms to Russia in this war. I actually thought it was an opening for Biden to China. Not just an important fact in and of this war, but I'm not comfortable with a drift in U.S.-China relations. I'm not in any way naive about the Chinese, but my philosophy has always been with China, build bridges where possible, draw red lines where necessary. I don't care to be into a cold war with China. I think the world would be a less prosperous and more dangerous place if we are. So every time I see an opening here, I say, well, let's nurture. Let's see where that can go. And I thought this was a moment to be actually nurturing and exploring the possibility of what I call Biden to China, but trying to actually improve U.S.-China relations at the time we're taking on Putin's Russia and not doing anything to provoke them outside of, Bob, any strategy. What is the strategy Nancy Pelosi is doing? Is this a swan song strategy? She thinks won't be speaker anymore. Has always had a very principled anti-China position on human rights. So she just thought she could go or should go. I don't mind if you're going to go, if you make the case, it's in the context of a strategy. And the way I tried to frame it in the column today was, here's what I think the strategy should be. I don't get this at all.
Yeah. Do you know, did she even consult with the executive branch before initially kind of deciding to go? you know, a couple of weeks ago, there was a report in the Financial Times that she was planning to go to Taiwan. Do you know at that point, had she even consulted with the White House, the Defense Department?
I think the word was informed, but not consulted. You know, she takes very seriously that they are a co-equal, separate branch of government. And this was, she took along her colleagues from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, as I recall. And so I think she informed them, and they then proceeded to inform her, from the CIA director to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, that this is a really bad idea at this time. And but she was not dissuaded. She went ahead with it. And you know, to me, at a minimum, Bob, it will, you know, nothing will come of it except some maybe a sound and light show the Chinese will put on over Taiwan. I hope that's that is the minimum. But there is a risk here that the Chinese would see the need to escalate in some military fashion. I don't know what. And and you start a tit for tat. I think, though, Bob, there's a larger strategic point here that one should take into mind. There is a school that believes that one reason Putin invaded Ukraine now, and there's kind of a weird symmetry between Ukraine and Taiwan, Ukraine, Russia, Taiwan, China, that he chose to invade at this time, that is last winter, because he saw the window of opportunity for such an invasion closing. Exactly how he calculated that, I don't know, but that maybe the Ukraine would be into the bosom of the European Union. It would have more military equipment. I don't know what it is, but there was the perception that Putin chose now because he saw a window of opportunity for keeping Ukraine in the Russian orbit closing. Mm-hmm. There's a real danger that that Xi and China will conclude that there is no peaceful way for China-Taiwan reunification, which has always been their claim and their expressed desire. And therefore, his window of opportunity is closing. And therefore, just because tomorrow Pelosi leaves and China hasn't, you know, blown up, you know, something in Taiwan, don't take that as, okay, that worked. That was all just mm-hmm. fine. This feeds into a larger strategic narrative for China. And my concern is that they will perceive their window closing or having been closed for a peaceful reunification and that they need to act militarily. I hope that isn't the case. But I think one has to really think about it in that way.
It's funny you should mention this because I'm writing a piece for my newsletter, Non-Zero Newsletter, that'll probably go up tonight where I'm kind of making that parallel in the context of a slightly larger argument. I'm arguing that the way the Ukraine war is being processed in America, you know, among foreign policy elites and so on, may come back to haunt us in Taiwan precisely because of these parallels. Yes. I mean, there is, you know, from the beginning, I've been saying that, yes, the arming of Ukraine was a two-sided coin. On the one hand, we like to think it would have a deterrent effect, maybe. It might help Ukraine defend themselves. But from Russia's point of view, of course, in keeping with what political scientists call the security dilemma, it may A, look like a threat, and B, they may decide, well, look, if our nightmare scenario is unfolding in any event, that is to say, Ukraine that is a de facto member of NATO, brimming with NATO weapons and advisors and so on, well, we might as well act now before there's even more weapons in Ukraine. So I've always thought that was a two-sided coin, and I've thought that there are parallels with Taiwan. For a long time, we've succeeded in conjunction with China, kind of in implicit coordination with them, in kicking the can down the road, right?
Can I just stop you there, Bob?
Sure.
I think it's a very good point you're making. I want to stop you because I think that term kicking the can down the road is so important in the Taiwan-China context. Because you hope somehow that evolution in China, evolution in Taiwan will result in some kind of peaceful arrangement to them. So any day we add to that calendar to me is a good day. And any day you cross off from that calendar and create the impression that that is not possible, to me is a really bad day and a really reckless day. And that's my critique of Pelosi. Okay, you wanted to go to Taiwan. In what strategic context are you doing this? You know, right. And that I think she really has to explain.
Right. So we've been saying for a long time, we understand China expects to unify with Taiwan. We don't want to say too much about it, but we, as long as it's peaceful, whatever happens is peaceful and fine. That has worked for half a century. Okay.
Yeah, that's the Shanghai Communique.
And that's been kicking the can down the road. It's worked. And I worry that a number of things together, including the further arming of Taiwan and maybe more assertive naval maneuvers by the U.S., who knows, and Pelosi going to Taiwan, will give them the idea that, you know, this game is coming to an end. And Taiwan is becoming not the kind of threat to China that Putin might imagine a NATO-ized Ukraine is to Russia. Not that. But they might say, look, interests we consider vital, which is to say that Taiwan doesn't leave you might say sphere of influence, although it's different from Ukraine, but doesn't kind of leave our orbit and kind of make fools of us and so on. That's a vital interest to us. And if it seems like that's going to happen with America's support and they're sending more and more arms to Taiwan, well, might as well act now. Now, I don't know. Again, there are both sides to the coin. Weapons yep. can have a deterrent effect. Yes. They can help you defend, but we need to acknowledge that they can boomerang on you in the same way. And the argument I'm making in my piece is, you know, I have been on the side in the Ukraine debate of arguing that, you know, maybe we made a mistake in sending more and more arms to Ukraine because of this other side of the coin. And all I'm not asking people to accept that I'm right. I'm asking them to accept that this is something that needs to be vigorously debated as it is applied to Taiwan, right? We need a robust debate about what happened in Ukraine because it is relevant to Taiwan, and that's in the future. We're not just dwelling on the past when we talk about the effect of NATO expansion and so on. This is a critical debate because it applies to Taiwan. And that's the argument I'm making. And I think, look, maybe I suffer from a persecution complex or something. It seems to me some powerful people have been trying to kind of marginalize and stigmatize my side of the debate. You know, we're parroting Putin talking points. We're justifying the invasion, which we're not. We say, you know, and so on. So that's the argument I'm making. We need to have a debate.
So let me react to that. I am a paying subscriber to your Substack. Because
God bless you. I'm a paying subscriber to the New York Times.
Exactly. Hold on. I'm a paying subscriber to your Substack because I want your perspective in my ear. If I've learned anything, you know, about all of these, you know, geopolitical stories, you really want to be hearing from everybody. And I think your perspective has merit. I think where I would critique it, where I say that the thing maybe is missing in your really nuanced argument is it underplays, I would say, Bob, the sheer notion of malevolence of Putin and Xi. That one can say Russia has these historical geopolitical concerns. One could also say that Putin really changed in the last 8 years. That the first 8 years of Putin, he was really Leon Aron, the historian, as he was writing a biography of Putin, says he was a distributor of wealth, and he really changed as the regime got more entrenched, more corrupt, I would argue, and that he really felt he needed to be a distributor of dignity more, and saw the conflict with Ukraine in that context. One could make the same argument about Xi. You know, I've always said about China that China today is so much more open than it was 40 years ago, and so much more closed than it was 8 years ago. There's been a real reversal. And Xi, I think, is a bad guy. I think he's bad for China and the world, and is not above wanting to use Taiwan as a way of deflecting from his own failures on COVID, on the massive debt bubble, on the real estate bubble, et cetera. And so what I'm trying to balance always is what I think is the very important question you're raising and asking us to ask. As you know, I was opponent of NATO expansion from the beginning, so I'm saying all this myself. With the sheer malevolence that that these aren't, that Putin does not equal Russia's national interests, and Xi doesn't equal China's national interests, that each one has political interests.
Absolutely.
And that are manipulative. And I think that's where I think has been the tension between our two arguments.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say a couple of things. First of all, Putin is a bad guy by my lights. I mean, you say he's gotten worse in the last 8 years. I want to address that. I believe it's true, because, and I believe we may have played a role, but that aside, yeah. He was a bad guy a long time ago. There's actual evidence that he was part of a false flag attack within Russia, as you no doubt know, right?
Absolutely.
That bombs
Absolutely.
That went off in Russian apartment buildings, killing Russian civilians in the late 1990s to gin up support, I guess, for the Chechen war or something, that he had a hand. We don't know for sure, but there's good evidence. Wouldn't put it past him. Not a good guy. That's for sure. But that's what you're dealing with, right? That's the player you got to play against. And as far as I also agree, he's gotten kind of worse, you might say. And I think part of it may be age, thinking about legacy. Am I going to be thought of as the man who restored Russian greatness? There's all that. But I also think there's something else. And here I would emphasize how much I agree with you that he's not just a national interest calculator. And although I have a lot of sympathy for the realists like John Mearsheimer, one place I depart is that you got to remember, he's got, And many realists acknowledge these kinds of things. John is pretty much a pure old-fashioned realist.
Right, yeah.
But
it's good actually to have someone who's the undiluted essence of realism as a bookend for the debate. But go ahead.
Right. I think, first of all, there are domestic political considerations. People underestimate the extent to which autocrats face them. I think autocrats care deeply how much people their people like them. And
one of my rules of journalism about is that no one polls more than dictators and autocrats.
That's right.
Nobody polls more.
And of course, they try hard to manipulate public opinion. All politicians do. They do so more repressively and have more levers to do it, but they can't do it infinitely. So they have to care how their policies work. Okay. And by the way, a footnote, we should keep that in mind in the context of Ukraine. Maybe we'll have time to talk about it in terms of his war aims and war achievements that he considers the minimum acceptable in terms of domestic politics. But the other place I agree with you is just he's a human being. He's got a psychology. He wants respect. Yeah. And of course, being an autocrat, he may identify more closely with Russia than some national leaders might with their countries. So for him, Russia getting respect, him getting respect, they may be largely the same thing. And I would say that I think the mistake that we made with NATO, and critically in 2008, when George W. Bush, against the advice of many people, including William Burns, who's now head of the CIA, was ambassador to Russia, when Bush invited basically Ukraine to join NATO against the better judgment of the Europeans, I think the mistake was not just in making Putin feel threatened in a national security sense. It was a sign of disrespect. Putin had made very clear, look, we think we're a great power. We have interests just like you do. And we have noticed, you keep violating international law, which at that point, Putin hadn't committed transborder aggression. Chechnya was inside of Russia, right? He hadn't invaded other countries. And he said, this is in his Munich Security Conference diatribe, right? He said, you guys have been violating international law. We're not happy about NATO expansion. And Bush just gave him the back of his hand. And I think that really matters. I mean, Putin is a guy who famously has a chip on his shoulder. Of course he cares about respect. Of course it's in your interest to at least go through the motions of showing him respect. We didn't. So I deny that I have some kind of narrow realist view of Putin as some kind of national security calculator. As domestic political interests, he has a psychology that we should take into account. I think all of these things argue against what the American policy has been. And I think they also at least raise doubts, I mean, as far as NATO expansion and Ukraine's role in it, but I think they also raise doubts about the wisdom of the pretty rapid arming of Ukraine since the middle of the Trump administration. Again, I'm not saying for sure I know that I'm right. I'm saying this is relevant to Taiwan, and we need to think clearly about what went wrong here. Because one thing I can say for sure is Those weapons did not have a deterrent effect on Putin. Okay, that didn't work. If you think that's what arming a country does, didn't work in this case.
So let me react to a couple of things. One is, I don't remember if we talked about this in our earlier podcast, but about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, I decided to change my business card from Thomas L. Friedman, New York Times foreign affairs columnist, to Thomas L. Friedman, New York Times humiliation and dignity columnist. Because I basically look back.
Wait. First, does it actually say that?
It actually says that.
Your call. It's your business card.
That's right. And because I realized I had spent really my 40 years covering people acting out on their humiliation and questing for dignity, mm-hmm. whether it's Palestinians versus Israelis, Muslim youth in Europe versus a Christian majority, China spoke about a century of humiliation, certainly Putin versus the West, that the two most powerful human emotions are humiliation and dignity, the quest for dignity and the rage. And the rage from being humiliated is like no other rage. You can cut my salary, you can even fire me, but if you humiliate me, I will fantasize that I have a bazooka on my shoulder mm-hmm. and I am blowing you away. And so I realized that I'd really spent my career covering people acting out on that sense of humiliation, questing for dignity. I'm working on a book now that the title of it is What You Say When You Listen. Because the biggest lesson I think I've learned as a journalist is that when you listen, listening is important for two reasons. One is what you hear, what you learn. All the mistakes I made were because I was talking when I should have been listening. But more importantly is what you say when you listen, because listening is a sign of respect. And it's amazing, I discovered over the years, what people will allow you to say to and about them critically if they think you respect them. And I had a particular angle on this because I was a Jewish kid from Minnesota, wanted to cover the Arab Muslim world in the 70s. That was not a natural thing. And the avenue for that was not a natural avenue. And hold on one second. And for anyone who followed my stuff on the Middle East, you know, it's not like I'm not out to say you're all great, you're all wonderful, it's all the Jews' fault. You know, I'm in people's face a lot. But the way I survived doing that was by always trying to be a really good listener. And I've always found if you will do that with people, it's not just what you learn, it's what you say when you listen. And that people will then actually take in, you know, what the point you're trying to get across. And that's been my, frankly, survival mechanism all these years. So I hugely agree with you. I that was my initial concern about NATO expansion, as was George Kennan's, that we are actually humiliating the Russians when they're weak, mm-hmm. and they will come back when they are strong. And the mm-hmm. same, I think when we say to China, you can't tell us what to do. The reverse of that is we can tell you what to do, you know, mm-hmm. and be careful. You know, I actually don't like to use the term China, Bob. I actually much prefer one-fifth of humanity who speak Chinese. Remember the scale here, folks, of what we're talking about. That's not a reason to surrender, to give in to what they say, but it's a reason not to go out of your way when you're already fighting a war in Europe indirectly with the other superpower to provoke this one when there is a certain parallel between Taiwan and Ukraine.
Mm-hmm. So you want to... is there anything else you want to say about Taiwan? I want to ask you some questions about Ukraine, but is there anything else you want to say about Taiwan?
Yeah, we're literally sitting here like I can't even look at my phone to know, like right now, who knows what China... We're literally at 0 hour right now. But I don't regret at all the column I wrote. I really thought, you know, it was, it's just so important for people to understand the context of this, not only Taiwan-China, but the global context that this is going on at a time when we are trying to, you know, produce a certain geopolitical outcome with the other global superpower. And this superpower, China, has actually helped us by mm-hmm. not arming Russia. And to me, that was, as I said, I'm going to repeat myself, but I repeat myself because it's so important. I'd actually rather not have a Cold War with China, everything being mm-hmm. equal. You know what I mean? I'd rather look for ways to be building bridges where we can, drawing red lines where we absolutely must. And I'm deeply concerned about, again, the direction of China is going, not just because of us, but again, because of Xi, his imperatives, his view of the world. And to the extent that we can avoid that, I think it's one of the most important missions I feel I have as a journalist to contribute intelligence to that discussion.
Yeah, and it seems to me the specific point you raised, the issue of China arming Russia right now when we don't want them to, is represents the broader concern that you just don't want to drive China toward Russia. You right. don't want to create a self-fulfilling exactly. prophecy here of this global war against all autocrats and authoritarians.
And that's where Nancy Pelosi really should be called on the carpet. What is your strategy? Given what I'm telling you, what you probably must know by now. And by the way, again, look at it from Beijing's point of view. They agreed to do something we requested for their own reasons, no doubt, and their own calculations about the war. But they did it mm-hmm. at a time when we are massively arming Ukraine in a way that's inflicting enormous harm on their, tacit ally, Russia. I mean, think of the dynamics from their point of view. And you see why, at least I believe, that the visit was ill-considered and really reckless.
Yeah. So speaking of, like, what is your plan? Do you think the administration has a plan in Ukraine? One thing Taiwan illustrates, as does this recent and not completely over dust up in Serbia with Kosovo, right, is that, look, the longer a war like this goes on, the more chances there are for just sparks that could turn it into something bigger. You would think you want to wind this down. Does the administration have a plan for anything other than this going on forever?
I don't think so. I think their only plan is that biology will take Vladimir Putin from the scene and someone else will replace him.
That's a pretty long-term...
One of the problems with this war, again, is that and what our conversations always bring out in me, Bob, is that this confluence of geopolitical imperative and the individual imperatives of leaders, personalities, quirks, passions, ignorances, and where one stops and the other starts. By the way, it applies to our leaders as well. So it's true of Putin and Ukraine. It's true of Xi and China. So if I were making the best case for the administration, I think their hope, I wrote about this a couple of weeks ago, is Putin has a winter strategy and we have a summer fall strategy. So Putin's winter strategy is basically just drag this war into winter. At that time, the pain of higher food prices and energy prices on Europe will be so great that they will force Zelensky to relent. But here, I just want to parenthetically throw the question back on you. What is Putin's aim? I don't know what his aim is. And he's actually never laid it out. We only know by what he's done on the ground. And so I think that's also a very important question we have to ask. So I believe, and the administration's is a summer fall strategy in the sense they've given these advanced arms, these HIMARS, these GPS guided rockets to the Ukrainians. And I am told, I have no independent verification of this, but I'm told by people in the government and what you read online by people who actually can track these things now, they're doing real damage to Russia, the Russian military. Now, that's also a two-sided coin because Putin, I believes he cannot lose this war. And if his army were to truly crack, I don't think his move is to raise a white flag. I think it's to press a button. And so that also can get really, really scary here. But the hope is, I think, of the administration is that if they can inflict enough damage on Putin in the summer and fall, he will agree to a pause in the war, some kind of ceasefire. And that might be able to spark, ignite, or create space for some kind of negotiation. That's I think, is the policy, as best I can divine it. But I think you also have to ask, Bob, what is his strategy? What is Putin's strategy? Yeah. I have no idea.
Well, it's funny, if you recall, the way this we wound up scheduling this conversation is you sent me an email about a piece I'd written in my newsletter where I, ventured to, put myself in Putin's shoes and kind of imagine what I thought it was like to be him. And first of all, I was arguing that I think you should think of him as, among other things, a politician and not just this exotic being from the East. And I said, so first of all, I think as a politician, he really feels he has to get Luhansk and Donetsk, which he doesn't have yet, because those were his minimally stated war aims, right? Yeah. I am going to acknowledge the sovereignty of these two, quote, republics. And that implied like they're going to be safe from Ukraine's clutches by the time I get through. Well, that hasn't happened yet. Okay. He has taken all of Luhansk, but not done yet. And one thing I said is, I think you got to understand he's going to expend a lot of manpower in order to secure Donetsk. That's my guess. And he's probably not going to be up for any kind of enduring peace before that, unless things, you know, become really, really bad for him, which I guess they could. The other thing I said is to remember that, you know, in a sense, America's overt involvement in this war is kind of his spiritual and political fuel. I mean, the more he can tell the Russian people that it's America and the American Empire is fighting against, the longer he can sustain support for this war, I believe. The other thing is something you've already, you know, when you said he might worry about him pushing the button is, I think you got to remember that when you start talking about rolling back the Russian troops, like getting them out of the Donbass, and certainly if you're serious about trying to get them out of Crimea, whether or not he considers that an existential threat to Russia, I think he's going to consider it an existential threat to his regime. That's right. The kind of thing that could lead to a palace coup. That is a failure, pure and simple, in political terms. He's not going to accept that. So I think those are three things you can assert with some confidence. I mean, I continue to see him as fundamentally a rational calculator. Yes, a human being with human psychology who has his idea of where he wants to fit into history. Absolutely. But I don't see any signs that he's crazy.
I would draw a distinction myself, if I could, between crazy and making a really big mistake. I believe from the very beginning, you know, the first question I asked when this war started back in February is like, gosh, where should I be? Should I be in Warsaw? Should I be in Berlin? Should I be in Lviv? Should I be in Kyiv? Should I be in Donbass? Should I be in Moscow? Should I be in Washington? And I've always felt from the very beginning, Bob, that the only place to be to really follow this war effectively is in Vladimir Putin's head. Because it really, this thing combusted there, it came out of there, and it will stop there. You know, so to me, what I worry about is just as maybe Ukraine can't stop or doesn't want to stop until it evicts Russia from every inch of Ukrainian territory, mm-hmm. my fear is that Putin can't stop either in this sense. You and I might say, well, he could go to the Russian people and say, I got the Donbass back, a Russian-speaking area, and a road from Crimea to Russia. And look, he's an all-powerful leader. He could sell that through his media mm-hmm. any way he wants. But I think he fears, this is just my guess and maybe projection, that after having lost 75,000 killed and wounded, 1,000-plus pieces of military equipment, every Western company out of Russia, to come to his people and say, my people, we're done, we won, I got you a road from Crimea through the Donbass to the motherland. I think he's afraid of actually ending the war where someone at home would do that math. I mean, we got this for that. Mm-hmm. And that's just projection, it's just my guess, maybe because if I were him, I would be afraid of doing that. He's not. I hope he's where your head is at, that he feels if he got the main pro-Russian, Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine back to the motherland, he could justify this war enough to stop it and move on. I wish, mm-hmm. I hope. My fear is that he feels he can't stop.
Well, if I was going to try to assuage your fear, I would say of these casualties, I mean, I don't know how exactly they're doing the counting, but first of all, a lot of the casualties on the Russian side are actually Russian-speaking Ukrainians in Donetsk and Luhansk who are fighting, you know, have been fighting for the separatists. A lot of people killed are them. And then on the Russian side, a lot of the people killed are kind of minorities out in the hinterland.
Exactly,
right.
Yeah.
It hasn't hit, you know, kind of his, well, you might say his ethno-nationalist base, if there is one. I don't think there are a lot of troops coming from the cities and so on. And I think the good news for you is he seems to very much want to avoid a general mobilization, because yes, sure. that would involve admitting, well, this wasn't just a military technical operation. It was an actual war. So
it gets back to your point about dictators polling. I mean, he right. doesn't that polls well, you know.
So I think he has incentive to, as much as I think he wants to take all of Donetsk, and as much as he certainly doesn't want to see troops significantly rolled back, their possessions significantly rolled back. I think, first of all, he might be willing to sacrifice some stuff at the bargaining table. Like, he doesn't want to lose Kherson under Ukrainian fire, but he might be more willing to let go of it for sanctions relief or something. Who knows? But I think there is political logic behind him ending this within a year. That's the hope. And one more thing. This just reminds me how irresponsible Nancy Pelosi is being. Because I think you and I have established that it's not all that easy to figure out how this ends. Yeah. One country that could help it end is China, right? Totally. They have so much leverage over Russia.
Yeah.
So what should we be doing with China right now? The opposite of saber rattling.
Exactly.
Right?
We should be doing a Kissinger-like move of lining up with them against Putin right now, using their leverage. And the war. I've actually had this conversation with Chinese diplomats. And I've argued to them, you know, she is, you know, going to become president for life or whatever. It's going to happen in October at the November at the Party Congress. But this is a moment for him to step out in the world and say, I'm inviting Russia, America, EU, Ukraine to you know, Bow Island. And we are going to try to end this war. It's very un-Chinese to step out that way. But that's what we should be encouraging, Bob. Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant by eyes on the prize, Nancy. What are you encouraging here? Actually, the kind of recklessness that you feared the Ukrainians had by making the Taiwanese think the Americans have my back. And by the way, there's a whole strand of thinking in Taiwan. That's why I said in my column, you know, I love Taiwan, one of my favorite countries. So many things have changed in Taiwan, except your geography. That hasn't changed. And small nations that lose sight of their geography, that they are a tiny island off mainland China, can really make mistakes. Their current president, I would argue, is from the sober school. But there is another school there that's constantly in tension with the sober school that says, we got the Americans at our back. Let's poke the panda bear. Mm-hmm. And this kind of visit only encourages it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was told, I didn't hear it, that's on Squawk Box this morning. Andrew Ross Sorkin read a paragraph from my column to Tom Cotton, senator from Arkansas, and asked him the sort of key argument of the column about Russia and the connection here. And I didn't see this, but I was told that Cotton said, well, why in the world should I listen to Tom Friedman? So in other words,
that's one way to avoid engaging your argument.
Exactly, not engaging the argument, but just, oh, he's a New York Times liberal and whatever, you know. And that's what also worries me. Pelosi, you know, Mitch McConnell's come out and endorsed her visit. Speaker of the would-be Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy, has endorsed her visit. They're goading her into doing this. They love this. And by the way, if it actually ends badly, they'll be nowhere to be found. They mm-hmm. will be nowhere to be found.
Yeah. Now, I read a Twitter thread from somebody who seems to know what he's talking about, suggesting that in terms of the blowback from this, that China will wait until Pelosi has left Taiwan, but will do something, some kind of show of force.
Yeah.
Presumably, we can weather that. But the longer-term problem that we're talking about, which is that in a certain sense, we need China more than ever right now. And in any event, a Cold War is just not good for the planet.
Can I give you a non-zero argument?
I love those.
And this is part of the book I'm working on now. So I think that the actual biggest divide in the world we're going into is no longer East-West, North-South, communist, capitalist, Russian, Chinese, American. It's going to be between the world of order and the world of disorder. That basically, I've been arguing this for a while, average is over for every worker. It's just much harder now to master all the skills you need for a good job. But average is over for countries too, Bob. So the 50 years after World War II were a great time to be a weak little country. Oh my God, if you were a weak little country, that was your era. There are two superpowers throwing money at you. army. Syria could lose three wars to Israel, get his army rebuilt for free all three times. Educating your kids at Patrice Lumumba University of Moscow or Wichita State in America, number one. Number two, climate change was moderate. Populations were small. No one had a cell phone. And China was not in the World Trade Organization. So everybody could be in the textile business, low-wage industries. My argument is all that flips in the early 21st century. Now, no superpower wants to touch you because all they think they win is a bill. Case in point, Afghanistan. Number two, climate change is now hammering these countries. Populations have exploded. Iran population, 1979, 40 million. Today, 85 million. And probably 500,000 people were born in Egypt since we began this conversation. Everyone has a cell phone to compare their country to the one next door. And oh, mine even now has a human trafficking app on it. China's in the World Trade Organization, so nobody can be in the textile business. Now, what this is doing is stressing out the weakest states, and they've started to fracture and hemorrhage their people. Yes, we broke a couple ourselves, but others are doing so just fine. Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, Haiti, and our hemisphere, Sub-Saharan Africa, all parts of the Middle East. And what they're doing is they're hemorrhaging their people, okay? And they're basically coming north, looking to get from the world of disorder to the world of order. You know, my view of Israel is to wider trends in civilization what Off-Broadway is to Broadway. So I always watch the trends in Israel. There, it's a very, very interesting microcosm. What's the biggest wall Israel built in the last decade? It ain't in the West Bank. It's a 250-kilometer fence in the Negev to keep people from Eritrea and South Sudan walking across the Sinai to Israel, and they're not looking for kosher food. Okay, if I dropped you, Bob, today in the Tel Aviv bus station and blindfolded you, but you could just hear and then took the blindfolds off and look around, you would say, am I in the Nairobi bus station? Mm-hmm. Because basically Israel now has 60,000 dreamers. These are kids born of these basically migrants, you know, who grow up speaking Hebrew and go to Israeli schools. It's a microcosm of the problem. Now, I believe the grand problem that we're going into in the world going forward is basically, how do we help stabilize these countries? It's a non-zero problem. It's going to require Russia, mm-hmm. China, mm-hmm. US, Japan, collaborating, creating what I call a complex adaptive coalition to actually help stabilize these countries. I leave you just with one example, which to me is one of the most important stories in the world. In 2018, Macron comes to Beirut after the explosion in Beirut port. You remember the terrible explosion right. that blew apart Beirut? He lands in Beirut, and I'm not making this up. As they say, you can Google it. And the first thing he gets is a petition signed from 60,000 Lebanese, please recolonize us. Please restore the French mandate. Now, what were those Lebanese saying? Or what was Macron saying when he said no? Macron was saying, you're too late for imperialism. That era is over. No one is going to come from the outside and order your disorder. But you failed at self-government. Bob, we haven't been here before. We've either lived in a world of empires mm-hmm. and big states, you know, or quasi-empires and a lot of 192 small states. But we now have states that are too late for imperialism. I'm not advocating it. I'm just saying it as a historical fact. No one's going to come from the outside. And they failed at self-government. What is to happen? Who's going to order Lebanon? Who's going to order Libya? Who's mm-hmm. going to order, you know, Somalia these days? And I think these zones of disorder are going to get bigger and bigger. And the only answer is the kind of new Marshall Plan, is collaboration between China, Russia, EU, Japan, the world of order to help stabilize these countries and give them a chance forward. I think it's the biggest non-zero geopolitical question going forward.
Well, some of these countries right now might tell you that China seems more interested in helping them than the U.S. is, and then they might have in mind the Belt and Road Initiative. And some people might
like Sri Lanka, but Sri Lanka is another version of Lebanon. You know, it's the same.
But I think, and some people might say, well, the Cold War had its virtues. You know, they're at least part of a bidding war. But I kind of agree with you that if you look at the way the Cold War played out, the motives of the great powers partly converge with the interests of some of these countries, but you also wind up with a lot of shenanigans that aren't good for the countries. It would be much preferable if the U.S. and China recognize that it's in their joint interest to stabilize the world. Absolutely. I mean, think about how visionary the American leadership would have to be compared to what we've had for that to actually happen. Sure. And look, Chinese leadership too, but I'm just speaking as an American. I don't see presidents thinking that way.
Well, you know, it's exactly right. And it's the problem because, you know, my favorite movie really of all time maybe is The Martian with Matt Damon. Because you remember how it ends, where the Chinese...
I haven't seen it, actually. But...
Oh, you should go see it. Actually, you'd love it. It's a very non-zero-ish ending. The Chinese end up using their booster rocket to save the Martian stranded on Mars, the American astronaut. And at the theater I was in at the ending, people applauded.
Mm.
It was kind of a vision that I think actually is in all of us. Wouldn't it be nice if we could do this? Now, this may be Tom Friedman, Minnesota, you know, naive kid, but I don't think this is just naivete. I'm telling you, folks, this is what I'd say to Tom Cotton. Mm. Well, what is your view of the world?
Yeah.
How do you think this is going to come out good? You know, that you just compete with your fellow Republicans over, you know, who can poke China the best? I mean, again, that's why I say, please don't talk to me about China. Talk about one out of five people on the planet who speak Chinese, okay? That's the scale of what we're talking about. And again, they may have a leadership, and I have real problems with Xi that make what I'm talking about impossible, but I want to do everything I can to explore the possibility of it, because I think the direction of the world right now is really scary to me.
Yeah. Well, what I'd like to say to everyone, including Tom Cotton, who thinks that, you know, woolly-minded liberals like me just aren't interested in pursuing the national interest, is that, no, that's not our argument. Our argument is that increasingly, as a result of technological evolution that's been going on for millennia, it is, in fact, in America's national interest to attend to some problems abroad and to coordinate and collaborate with countries abroad. I think it's just a fact. And look,
we can't do it all ourselves. The problem is too big. You know?
Right, right. So can I ask you before you go about a couple of paragraphs in today's column, which fascinated me? I'm going to read them. You're talking about Pelosi's... I'll join it midstream. Privately, U.S. officials are a lot more concerned about Ukraine's leadership than they are letting on. There is deep mistrust between the White House and Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky, considerably more than has been reported. And there's funny business going on Kyiv. On July 17th, Zelensky fired his country's prosecutor general and the leader of its domestic intelligence agency, the most significant shakeup in his government since the Russian invasion in February. It would be the equivalent of Biden firing Merrick Garland and Bill Burns on the same day. But I've still not seen any reporting that convincingly explains what that was all about. It is as if we don't want to look too closely under the hood in Kyiv for fear of what corruption or antics we might see when we have invested so much there. First of all, it sounds like you may know a little more than you wrote. And if you want to share that with us, feel free. But I also have a question aside from that.
Well, you know, I said early on in this war, when I wrote a column dinging Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, for saying we want to destroy Russia or bring down Russia or whatever.
Weaken
them, yeah. I want to keep our goals really tight, number one. And the other, I've learned the hard way, Bob, really the hard way. Never fall in love with any of these countries. They're all jack in the box, and you never know what's going to pop out. Let's remember, most Americans still couldn't find Ukraine on a map with 10 tries. And when you get this deeply embedded in a country, that if you look up the list on global corruption, Transparency International, I think Russia was like right there near the top of 160, but like Ukraine was like 130. I mean, this was a country with a lot of corruption problems before the war started. And they don't just go away like that. And so I've just had people say things to me in the administration through the process of my reporting, you know, commenting on the fact that there remains corruption there. And when we're putting that much money into a vessel, this is not Norway, I'm very worried about, I don't want to wake up at the end of this war, whenever it comes, and find that, you know, billions have been siphoned off into Swiss bank accounts, et cetera. So I'm just sending up a flare that the biggest thing I learned, I think, as a journalist, among the biggest things, is that when you don't call things by their real name, you get in trouble. You know, when you don't, and that was simply as I did with the Austin article. You know, if bad shit is happening there, like that, When you fired the attorney general, could that be maybe because she was about to investigate some people that some people inside shouldn't be investigated right now? I don't know. All I know is that's a story that went by in which I said, whoa, what is at the bottom of that story in you know? And I want to know that now. I want all the dark stuff out now, you know what I mean, as we go along. Let's address it, fix it, move on. And so I put that flare up intentionally in that article.
Yeah, well, one problem I've had with the framing of this war, I thought that the way to look at it is, look, Russia violated international law, transport of aggression, that's bad. The framing has, the official framing has been more like, this is a war on behalf of liberal democracy. And one problem with that is Ukraine is a democracy, not all that liberal a democracy. Right. And if you're committed to the narrative that it is, you're going to have to start overlooking stuff and covering stuff up.
But that's why my point is, my point has been, let's do our business. Our business was, this was violating, you know, the international border of Ukraine, unprovoked in my view. If Putin could do this here, he can do it all over Europe. Let's reverse this, period, paragraph, end it. Whatever happens after that, you know, we can address, but don't fall in love. Don't fall in love with your narrative or theirs.
I mean, I have heard for some time, not in mainstream media emphatically, though, that, you know, Zelensky may not have as much power as you might think a president would have. And there are forces behind the scenes, maybe oligarchs. Maybe the Azov Brigade has been known to play hardball, and they represent a significant right-wing movement. And there might be government officials who fear that they'll actually be killed or something if they, you know, that it's a lot more complex than we think, and significantly less like America than we think. I mean, have you heard stuff like this or?
Yeah, I think that there's just he's, first of all, it is a democracy in that he's constantly worrying about who's going to challenge him, who comes next as president. There are factions. There are financial interests that we know in this country. There are a lot of Ukrainian oligarchs. And all I'm kind of saying by putting that in my column is that, and I will do more reporting on this myself, is I want to know everything now. I don't want to be closing my eyes and not reporting something because I fear that it will weaken my side in this war. Now, I think we're strengthened. Mm-hmm. Let's know exactly who we're with. We know all of their problems. It doesn't change the fact that the principle we're defending is, I think, both important and just. But let's not blind ourselves and not report on things that I hear people whispering to me that I want to know more about.
Right. So this, I want to reread these two sentences again of yours, but I have still not seen any reporting that convincingly explains what that was all about, is if we don't want to look too closely under the hood. Well, that's a critique of reportorial journalism in America. And I'm wondering if you think, I personally think, It's kind of gone downhill, and partly as a result of the Trump era, when kind of the mainstream media understandably reacted so strongly against Trump, and I think in some cases departed from objectivity in more than usual. I mean, look, we can never be objective, but I mean, got more into the business of sustaining an anti-Trump narrative than trying to do the most objective reporting possible every single day. I think that happened. I think technological forces, by bringing us in touch with how many people are reading each article and clicking on each headline, I think that has its own pernicious effect. But sure. But I just wonder if I'm wrong in thinking that the way the Ukraine war is being covered, I guess I'd say it seems to me that the American media broadly is covering it the way we would cover a war that we ourselves are involved in almost. There's that degree of departure from objectivity, does that make any sense to you? Or are you pretty happy with the way the war is being covered repertorially?
Yeah. You know, I have a certain allergy to press criticism, I confess, often being the object of it. So I'm really wary. I also have a lot of sympathy for, this is a dangerous place right now. I mean, to try to cover this war. I mean, you don't want a rock to land on you anytime, anywhere. I put that in there just to highlight that let's make sure that we're telling the reader everything about this country we know or can find, because I want to know it now. It doesn't, not because I want to get out of the war or whatever, because I don't want to be surprised at the end. And I want to keep my eyes on the prize, which is rolling Russia back out of Ukraine, which I think is the key principle for the future of Europe and is an important feature for important factor for international relations generally going forward. And if Ukraine, you know, is less of a democracy or more of a democracy, I don't know how much we can control of that. That's in their fate. That's in their that is in their hands. But I just want to make sure I'm telling myself this, I'm putting it in my own column, that you're searching for and understanding and not romanticizing this. Again, my shorthand for it was don't fall in love. Let's do our business and get out. I don't want this war to be the rest of my life.
And when you say we want to roll Russia out of Ukraine, do you think that's can realistically be done without incurring unacceptable risk, given what you've said about Vladimir Putin pushing the button under?
What I say, I'm all for any peaceful diplomatic solution that Ukraine and Russia can come to terms with. And if that involves Russia maintaining some kind of referendum in the Donbas or some kind of control there, that's just the balance of power. I think bringing this war to the quickest peaceful end is the most important thing. And it goes back to what I said when the war started, Bob. This, to me, is the first world war. This is the first real world war. World War I was not a world war. Half the world was colonized then. They didn't have a voice in anything. And many people were just subsistence farmers. They weren't affected. To some extent, the same in World War II. This is truly the first world war, where 2 weeks after it started, Argentinian farmers couldn't afford the diesel fuel for their tractors and couldn't get the fertilizer they needed. And so the point you made earlier on, I really believe every week this war goes on is more dangerous. Mm-hmm. Something bad can happen, some miscalculation. The sooner we can get to a pause and negotiations, the better it is.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tom. Is there anything else you want to say? I really encourage people to read the column you wrote today on Pelosi and Taiwan and Ukraine.
No, this was fun as always. I always enjoy these conversations. You make me think. And I commend everyone to read and subscribe to your Substack. And
I'm saying God bless you again, Simon. Yeah. Thanks so much. Thanks for taking the time. Let's do this again down the road.
Absolutely, Bob. Thanks so much.